Right in. God, we come to you with all of our anxieties and all of our worries and all of our fears and all the unfinished business from this past week. And we look toward a new week with all sorts of new potential and possibilities and lots of things that could happen, may happen. Some of us may be moving into this new week with all sorts of anxiety. So wherever we find ourselves today, may we just be open to your voice. We don't believe that we have to manufacture your presence here. We believe that you're always with us. As the psalm says, that there's no mountain so high or depth so low that we can escape you. You're everywhere. You're like the air we breathe. And so help us to breathe deeply today of your presence, of your grace, of all that you have for us. May we be met with joy and hope and a sense of peace that whatever is happening in our lives outside of this room right now, that we're not alone. And that is something to be truly, truly grateful for. It's in the name of the one in whom we live and move and have our being that we ask these things. And everybody said, amen. So we started back in August with the story of creation, and somebody remarked it took God 7 days, but it took me about 5 weeks or whatever to get through that. So we moved on from creation. God made a good world, and it was beautiful, and it was good, and everything was in harmony and balance. And then we enter into this period of crisis. God created a good world, and he put humans in this world as his image bearers, but these human beings chose to grasp for being God. We wanted to be God, and we weren't content to be God's image bearers. And so what that created as a result of that was an estrangement and a difficulty in our relationship with God. And not only that, but a difficulty in our relationship with one another. I mean, the first people, when they sin, what happens? They begin blaming one another. And then their relationship with creation is kind of out of balance. And so there's all this crisis. And we began reading the story, and we saw it really started getting really, really bad. The world was a very violent place, not a good place to be. And so how do you fix that world if you're God? Well, God calls a man named Abraham, and he calls his family to be God's kind of representatives in the world in a way. And he says to Abraham, I'm going to bless you and your family so that you can go bless the whole world. And through your family, Abraham, everything's going to change. Nothing will be able to be the same. Because you said yes, and because you're going to do what you're going to do. But we even saw with that, even with this family now that God is putting together through Abraham. We looked at the story of Jacob and Esau last week, and we saw that even within Abraham's family, the kids aren't getting along, and there's all sorts of chaos. But the thing that gives us hope is that when Jacob and Esau come face to face, and if you missed last week, it'll be online this week. We've been having some trouble with that. But when Jacob and Esau come face to face after about 20 years of separation, after Jacob has lied, cheated, and stolen, what does Esau do? Esau forgives. And we get this kind of hint that perhaps the way God's going to repair the world isn't through vengeance and it isn't through retribution. Maybe the way God's going to seek to bring peace in the world is through forgiveness. It's through grace. It's through emulating God, modeling God. How does God act toward people? God is forgiving and gracious. And when we are forgiving and gracious, it makes real change and healing possible in the world. And today we're going to move on to the captivity movement of the Bible. We're going to meet some ancestors of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob who are now in Egypt. And I need to fill in that little arrow between calling and captivity. A lot happens. Jacob, who was the product of a dysfunctional home because his mother loved him, but his father loved his brother. Jacob continues that kind of parenting, and he has 12 sons. He has, at the point when the story begins, he has one son by his favorite wife, Rachel. He has a lot of sons by his wife, Leah, who the Bible says, we looked last week, she had weak eyes, which meant she's not very attractive, and he didn't really like her very much. He liked Rachel. She gave him one son, Joseph, and he gives Joseph a Technicolor dream coat. And he makes such a huge difference between Joseph and his brothers that his brothers hate him. And so Joseph's brothers say, here's what we got to do. We got to deal with Joseph. He gets all, you know, mom and, you know, they give him all the good stuff because dad loves him more than he loves us. So we're going to kill him. But then they start thinking about it. And they think killing is wrong. Right? I mean, some of us, you have brothers and I'm an only child, but you have brothers and sisters. You've probably been in this spot before. Killing my brother or sister would be wrong. So they decide, here's what I'm going to do instead. We'll just sell him into slavery because that's more humane. That's a better option than murder. We won't go all the way with homicide. We'll just sell him, which really doesn't seem like that much of a win for Joseph, does it? They sell Joseph into Egyptian slavery. And you need to read the story of Joseph if you have it. Lots of things happen, lots of ups and downs in his story. But at the end of Genesis, Joseph has risen to second in command in the Egyptian empire. He answers only to Pharaoh. He has devised a plan to get Egypt through a famine. And so he's essentially the savior of Egypt because he is prepared in advance for what's happening. And guess who shows up from Canaan to get food from Joseph and the Egyptians? Remember those brothers we talked about a second ago who sold him into slavery? His brothers show up. And he's been in Egypt so long, they don't recognize him anymore. He's more of an Egyptian than he is a Canaanite now. And his brothers come before him. And there's this great scene where Joseph messes with him a little bit because that's only fair. And then he reveals himself. I'm your brother Joseph who you thought you sold into slavery. And they get really nervous. And Joseph comes off with this great line. Because remember, how's God going to put the world back together? Not through revenge, but through forgiveness. He says, you intended to harm me, but God intended something good. God took the mess you made of my life, and God brought about something amazing because now lots and lots of lives are being saved because this happened. So he forgives his brothers. And they bring their dad, and the whole family relocates to Egypt because there's food. And now when we come to the story of Exodus, where we're going to be this morning in Exodus 1, 400 years have gone by. Joseph's family has been living not in the promised land, they've been living in Egypt for 400 years. A lot can change in 400 years, would you agree? And so here's where we pick up the story. And if you don't, hopefully you sense kind of the this is a big problem, what's about to happen. A new king came to power in Egypt who didn't know Joseph. I mean, this is the writer of the Exodus way of saying things are about to go south really quickly for these people. A new Pharaoh, a new king takes the throne. He said to his people, the Israelite people are now larger in number and stronger than we are. Come on, let's be smart and deal with them. Otherwise, they will only grow in number. And if war breaks out, they will join our enemies, fight against us, and then escape from the land. I don't know if you've noticed this, but power often brings with it paranoia. In the New Testament, when we get there around Christmas, you're going to meet King Herod. And we're supposed to think that Herod's like Pharaoh because what Pharaoh is about to do is the same thing that Herod does in the New Testament. And it's all because he's afraid of his power being challenged. Why is Pharaoh worried about the Israelites? Because they are multiplying and multiplying and multiplying. And what if they outnumber us? And what if they take power away from us? So we've got to do something to keep them from overpowering us. So, as a result, the Egyptians put foremen of forced work gangs over the Israelites to harass them with hard work. They had to build storage cities named Pithom and Ramses for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they grew and spread, so much so that the Egyptians started to look at the Israelites with disgust and dread. So the Egyptians enslaved the Israelites. So the more they oppress them, the more they produce offspring. Right? The harder they work them, the more they grow in number. They made their lives miserable with hard labor, making mortar and bricks, doing field work, and by forcing them to do all kinds of other cruel work. The king of Egypt spoke to two Hebrew midwives named Shiphrah and Puah. When you are helping the Hebrew women give birth, and you see the baby being born, if it's a boy, kill him, but if it's a girl, you can let her live. Now, on the scale of one to absolutely bonkers, how mad and upset would you be in reading this? This is awful, right? And it's a little confusing because in the ancient world, it was very common, even in the first century in the Greek-Roman culture, it was very common. There's actually a letter that has been preserved from a Roman soldier writing to his wife who's pregnant. If it's a boy, let him live. And if it's a girl, expose her, which means take her out into the kind of the wilderness and just leave the baby there and she'll die of starvation. Something will eat her. This was very common because it was a patriarchal culture. Women didn't matter. Men did. And so, nobody wanted a girl because they can't work. So you take the girl and get rid of her. That's just another mouth to feed. If it's a boy, let him live. Very common in the ancient world. This is kind of the flip side reverse. I mean, it seems like, and maybe we're supposed to kind of take notice of this. It seems like Pharaoh is getting rid of his labor by killing the boys. But at the same time, he's creating the possibility of having more Israelites by leaving the girls around, right? But there's actually a story outside the Bible that Jewish rabbis have told about this, and they said, well, what we think happened is Pharaoh had a dream. And in the dream, he saw that there was going to be an Israelite male who would be raised up by the Israelite God to bring freedom. And so it's not in the text, but people have tried to explain, why does the Pharaoh act this way? Is it because he has this sense that it's the Israelite, there's going to be this Israelite leader who's going to be brought up from this? Now, the two midwives respected God, so they didn't obey the king, the Egyptian king's order. Instead, they let the baby boys live. So the king of Egypt called the two midwives and said to them, why are you doing this? Why are you letting the baby boys live? The two midwives said to Pharaoh, because Hebrew women aren't like Egyptian women. And don't you imagine that it was at this point where they did that kind of snap? Because Hebrew women aren't like Egyptian women. Egyptian women be weak. Hebrew women are stronger. And they give birth before any midwives can get to them. I mean, do you see kind of in this ancient story, the Hebrews, or the writers kind of going, Egyptians stink. They're just bad, right? They're just weak. And the Hebrew women, they're strong and tough. So God treated the midwives well. People kept on multiplying and became very strong. And because the midwives respected God, God gave them households of their own. Then Pharaoh gave an order to all his people. Throw every baby boy born to the Hebrews in the Nile River, which was kind of sacred to the Egyptians. So that you could almost look at this as a sort of human sacrifice in some way. But you can let all the girls live. So if it's a boy, throw it in the Nile River. If it's a girl, let her live. Now, what happens? So the Israelites keep producing children, and we are invited into the story of this one family who they have a baby boy, and they just can't comply with what Pharaoh's asked them to do. They just know it's wrong, and so they say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put him in the river, but we're going to build a basket. And the word basket, it gets translated basket, but it means ark. It's the same word used in Genesis to describe Noah's boat, right? So they make an ark out of reeds, and they place the baby in the ark, and they send it down. So they technically complied, right? I mean, if you're a kid, you know this is what you do to your parents all the time, right? I technically did my homework. I didn't do it well, but I technically, it's the technicality. They technically send the baby down the river. Well, Pharaoh's daughter is bathing in the Nile, and here comes this ark floating by. And she hears the cry of this baby, and she goes over and she looks, and inside the ark, there's a baby. And she takes this baby, adopts him, and names him Moses, which in Hebrew means to draw out, like I drew him out of the water. But Moses is actually has Egyptian roots. There is a Pharaoh named Tutmosis. What you have in Moses is you have this dual identity. You have the Hebrew slave tradition. This is what he grew up in. But now he's been brought into the royal household. So Moses is going to grow up more Egyptian than he is Hebrew. He's brought into the Egyptian household. He's going to hear about the Egyptian gods. He's going to be a part of the Egyptian economy. He's going to be a part of the power structure that is oppressing his people. And so one day Moses gets older, and he's looking down from the palace, and he sees an Egyptian slave master beating a Hebrew slave. And something in Moses clicks, and these are his people. He's not Egyptian. He's Hebrew. And so Moses attacks the Egyptian slave master, and he kills him, and he buries him in the sand. A couple days later, Moses is looking down. I mean, you think if you're Moses, you stop looking down because bad things happen. He looks down, and he sees two Hebrews fighting, and so he goes to break it up. And he says to them, you shouldn't be doing this to one another. I mean, the Egyptians are, you should be against the Egyptians. You shouldn't be doing this. And they say, what are you going to do? You're going to kill us and bury us in the sand too? And this is kind of a hint that the story has gotten out, that Moses wasn't as careful as he thought. And so he realizes if Pharaoh finds out that I defended a Hebrew over an Egyptian, I'm going to be toast. So he gathers his stuff and he heads out into the desert to a place called Midian. So you have this Hebrew slave who grew up as an Egyptian who is now in another foreign place in the area of Midian. And he meets a guy named Jethro. And every time I hear the name Jethro, do you know what immediately pops in my mind? The Clampets, right? The Beverly Hillbillies. And you just imagine that he chose Jethro's daughter because Jethro had the cement pond. And nobody else in the ancient world had one. And so Moses is in Midian with Jethro and Elimelech and the whole family. And he is a shepherd. He has left Egypt. He's left the power, the wealth, the privilege of Pharaoh's household. He's hiding out. And I would imagine Moses feels like his story is over. This is, I mean, when you kill somebody and you run away and you hide for roughly 40 years in the desert, I mean, you probably got the hint, like, anything that was going to happen for me, it's over. I've had my chance. But notice what happens. He becomes a shepherd. Moses was taking care of the flock for his father-in-law, Jethro, Midian's priest. He led his flock out to the edge of the desert, and he came to God's mountain called Horeb. It's also called Sinai in the Bible. The Lord's messenger appeared to him in a flame of fire in the middle of a bush. Moses saw the bush was in flames, but it did not burn up. It was very common in this, in the desert, to see possibly a lightning strike or something hit a dry bush and it was burning. But this one didn't burn up. So he said, let me check out this amazing sight and find out why the bush isn't burning up. When the Lord saw that he was coming to look, God called to him out of the bush. Moses, Moses, where have we seen this before? Do you remember when God called Abraham? What did he say to him? Abraham, Abraham. And how did Abraham respond? Here I am, right? What do you think Moses is going to say? Here I am, I'm here. The Lord said, don't come any closer. Take off your sandals because you are standing on holy grounds. The rabbis have debated for years. What did that mean? Did it mean that ground suddenly became holy, or was Moses being made aware that God's presence is everywhere and all ground is holy ground? It's not just in front of this particular plant that's on fire. Everywhere you step, you are in the presence of God. There is no such thing as ground that is not holy ground. He continued, I am the God of your father, Abraham's God, Isaac's God, and Jacob's God. Why would he have to identify? Why did God identify God like that? Where's Moses grown up? Egypt. So his God, the gods he's familiar with at this point are Ra, the sun god, Anubis, God, I think God of the end of the world. He's familiar with Midian's God, whoever Jethro's the priest for. This God is new. I mean, he's probably heard through the grapevine from his, family in slavery that there was this God that they believed in back in Canaan. But this is a new God in some ways. This God has to say, this is who I'm talking about, your great-grandfather. I'm talking about Abraham, I'm talking about Isaac, I'm talking about Jacob. Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I've clearly seen my people oppressed in Egypt. I've heard their cry of injustice because of their slave masters. I know about their pain. I've come down to rescue them from the Egyptians in order to take them out of that land and bring them to a good land, a good and broad land, a land that's full of milk and honey. Now the Israelites' cries of injustice have reached me. I've seen just how much the Egyptians have oppressed them. So get going. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And this is a big, big moment. And actually, this is the moment of Jewish history. The defining moment for Jews, if you ask them today, they love Father Abraham, he's their father, but if you say, what is the defining moment of Hebrew history? They're going to tell you it's when God heard the cry of the slaves and he sent Moses to lead them to liberation. That's the epic moment of Hebrew history. They keep coming back to this. During the Babylonian exile, when their temple had been destroyed and they were deported to Babylon, do you know what stories they told? God sent Moses to Egypt and led them to freedom. Do you know what God's going to do for us? If God could do that once, then God's going to do it again. When Jesus was on the scene in the first century, do you know what story they kept telling over and over again in the first century? When the Romans were occupying the Holy Land, do you know what story they told? If God could send Moses, maybe God will raise up another leader, a Messiah, who will lead us out of slavery and into freedom. Every year the Jews celebrate a meal called Passover, which reenacts this moment when God liberated the people. I mean, this is the central defining moment for Jewish history. There's a couple things, though, reading this story again that I missed the first 33 years. I read this, well, I probably wasn't reading all 33 years, but the first, whatever I was reading. This Exodus story absolutely flips the script. And here's what I mean by that. In the ancient world, things worked a very particular way. If we can think about ancient power structures, let's think about ancient societies as the power structures being in a pyramid, because we're in Egypt, right? So we'll just do the pyramid. In the ancient world, in Egypt, who's at the top of the pyramid as far as power goes? Pharaoh, right? Pharaoh. Who's at the bottom? Slaves, right? So you have Pharaoh at the top, slaves at the bottom. How does Pharaoh justify his power? Here's how he justified. This is how everybody in the ancient world justified it. And aren't you so glad we don't do this in today's politics? Sarcasm intended. They said, Pharaoh said, you know why I'm in charge and you guys aren't? Because the gods put me in charge. It's because Ra, the sun god, has given me power that I'm powerful. And so if you resist my rule and you resist slavery and you resist all this stuff, do you know who you're ultimately resisting? You're not resisting me. You're resisting who? The gods. This This argument was actually repeated in the American South at one point when they were telling slaves, it says in the Bible you need to be good slaves, and so if you resist that, you're not resisting us, you're resisting God. I mean, you see how the Bible can be used in crazy, destructive sorts of ways. And so Pharaoh was essentially a representative of God. If you have a problem with Pharaoh, you have a problem with God. What is absolutely powerful about this story? In this story, whose side is God on? He appears to Moses and said, what? I've heard the cry. I'm sending you to Pharaoh. Go get my people. Whose side is God on? In the ancient world, God is always for the powerful. God is always for the wealthy. God is always for the ones who are at the top. And we read the Bible sometimes and we read about these rituals and laws and we think that really sounds kind of, you know, ancient and regressive and barbaric, and we don't do those sorts of things. But the reality is, this, when the Bible does this kind of thing, this is absolutely fresh and progressive and absolutely unthinkable in the ancient world. That God could be for the slaves, this is paradigm shifting. God is on the side of slaves, not on the side of Pharaoh. God is on the side of the oppressed, not on the side of the oppressors. God is on the side of the marginalized and the mistreated, not on the side of those who are doing the marginalizing and mistreating. Do you see why this is a dangerous message? Do you see why telling a group of slaves that God is actually on their side and not on their slave master's side? Do you see why this is a dangerous message? I mean, this threatens everything for Pharaoh. So that makes me ask this question. When are we on God's side? When are we actually on God's side? Because, I mean, I think we always want to make God on our side, but maybe the real question is, when are we on God's side? I think we're on God's side anytime we are caring about the poor and the oppressed in the world. When we are caring about the least and the lowliest, that's when we're on God's side. It's not when we are caring about taking care of our own interests and our own power, our own wealth. And I want to say this up front. Being wealthy isn't wrong. If you have a lot of money, good job. Right? The Bible is not condemning people for wealth. Here's what the Bible condemns. It condemns when people who have a lot of wealth use all their time and energy to preserve their wealth and power. Right? That's what Pharaoh's up to. I've got to preserve my wealth and power because these Hebrews, there's a lot of them, they may take over, so we've got to keep our wealth and power secure at any cost. When are we on God's side? We are on God's side when we are standing with God, caring about the poor and the oppressed and the least. Conversely, when are we not on God's side? Or when is God not on our side? It's when we're using our wealth and privilege to simply prop up our wealth and privilege. The problem isn't being wealthy. The problem is, what are we doing with our wealth? And by the way, if you have an American passport, the majority of us in this room would be considered wealthy and powerful in the world. We would be considered wealthy and powerful. What are we doing with our wealth and power? Because when we find ourselves simply propping up our own wealth and power and our own privilege, then we are not on God's side anymore. Because God's on the side of the poor. And God's on the side of the oppressed. It would almost be like saying, God isn't on the side, and for whatever political reasons, some of you are going to agree with this, and don't take this way, but God is not on the side of the White House. Or the House or the Senate. God is on the side of the people in our country, in our community, in our world who have the least amount of power and the least amount of the people who are barely able, if they even can, get by and feed their family. Those are the people God, he's on their side. And we are only on God's side when we're on their side too. Does that make sense? I mean, that's an unbelievable sort of statement in the Bible, that God cares about the poor. And when the Israelites would be free of Egypt, they would go to their own land and they would build a big fancy temple and they would have a lot of power and wealth and they would have a king who was super wealthy. And guess what this king did? He started holding slaves. And you have, so the slaves now are the slave masters, and you actually have prophets who stand up in Israel and they say things like this: God is on the side of the poor. Have you forgotten Egypt? Have you forgotten what God did for us when we were on the bottom of the ladder? And now we're on the top of the ladder and we have slaves and we're mistreating the poor, and this can't be right. And so there's this powerful way the Bible, it doesn't just make the Hebrews the good guys. It points out that after they were free, they did some really bad things and made some bad choices. And then the second thing that really stood out to me that I never really noticed before is that God really needs a body. What does he say to Moses? I'm really concerned about the Israelites. So go. I'm going to send you to do something about it. How many of you have ever said something like this? Why doesn't God just, and fill in the blank? Why doesn't God just cure the world hunger issue? Right? How many of you ever said that? Why doesn't God just bring about world peace? I mean, besides it would totally wreck the Miss America pageant. But if there was another reason, why doesn't God just bring about world peace? Why not? Why not? Why not? Why doesn't God do something about the homeless problem in Butler County? Why? There's an Irish philosopher named Peter Rollins who, when I can understand what he's saying, I really think he's brilliant and funny. And he tells this story about a pastor. And this pastor, she was asleep, and a knock came at her door in the middle of the night. And she opens the door, and there's this man out of breath. And he says, Pastor, you won't believe this, but a member of our church, this family, the husband just lost his job. They're barely hanging on. And now their house has just burned down. Can the church do anything to help them? Because the landlord is not going to take care of them. He's gonna like take everything and leave them with nothing. And they're not going to be without home. They're going to be without stuff. And the landlord needs to cover his losses. And this family is going to be left out to dry. And the pastor says, of course the church will help. We'll do whatever we can. But can I ask, how do you know so much about the situation? He said, well, because I'm the landlord. I think that's the situation. Man, it would be really great if God did something. And we forget that God needs a body. God's looking for people who will step up and join him. God is what if God is ultimately, for all these things that matter to us in the world that we wish would happen, what if God is waiting on somebody who's willing to join him? When Jesus dies and rises again, he ascends. So Jesus is physically not present anymore. And the first Christians start talking about what that means. And they come up with this language. Paul says that we are the what of Christ? Body. Body. Built within our own Christian tradition, there's this sense of God needs a body. God needs somebody to incarnate and put into practice these things. Because the world is not going to get better on its own steam. And the world is not going to get better. I mean, praying is great, but you can sit in your room and pray all day. It would be much better to get up and do something. Because it's when we get up and do something and we join God in the rescue and repair of the whole world that makes the world better. If we feel like, and I hear Christians all the time talking about how bad the world is, it's really on us. It's on us. Not because we haven't protested and condemned entire groups of people. We tried that. It doesn't work. It's on us because there are real issues in the world that need to be addressed, and we aren't addressing them. We're waiting on God to address them, and I think God is waiting on us to be available. Brian McLaren says, often in the Bible when there's a big problem, God prepares a person or people to act as God's partners or agents in solving it. In other words, God gets involved by challenging us to get involved. It would really make you think of our prayer lives differently, wouldn't it? What if, you know, God, would you please go do this for those people? What if we actually took it upon us to answer that prayer? If you have a neighbor who's hungry, don't pray for them. Go buy them groceries and then pray for them. I mean, it's this sort of practical joining God in what's actually happening around us. That he says to Moses, Moses, I want you to go. And now you need to know this. If you read the story, Moses resists and resists and resists. And at the end, God kind of says what we say to our kids sometimes. We ask them to do something and they just say no. And we say, oh, I'm sorry. You thought that was like an option. This is not an option, Moses. Go. I'm choosing you. This is pre-Charlton Heston Moses. Afraid, unsure, go. I'm choosing you because God needs a body. And then two things, just by way of application, then we're going to celebrate communion. One is no matter what we think, slavery isn't a problem of the past. It isn't. Slavery is not a problem of the past. Now, thankfully, institutional slavery has been gone for a while here in the United States, and that's a great thing. It's embarrassing that we even had it, but thankfully, that's gone. And I think we tend to transpose what's happening in America is happening in the whole world. So there's no slavery in the world today, and everybody's free, but that's just not the case. Studies say around 21 to 30 million people in the world today are trapped in slavery. Actually, in the island of Hispaniola, where the Dominican is, where we have partnerships, Haiti is number two in human trafficking in the world, or it was when these statistics came out. Number two. And human trafficking is basically, let's say your job is a salesman, and you wake up every morning, and you go door-to-door, and you're an orange salesman. I don't know what the market is for orange salesmen in Butler County, but let's just imagine that's your job every morning. You go door-to-door, and you're trying to convince people to buy an orange. Human traffickers, they do that with people. Right, they kidnap people. They take people sometimes in certain parts of the world. Fathers will sell their daughters into slavery. And it usually ends up being a sort of sexual variety where women are. And as you can see, 55% of are women and girls, and 26% are children. So it's women, children being sold to other human beings so that they can abuse them sexually, so that they can abuse them physically. And that's happening in our world. 31 to 30 million people makes $150 billion a year for human trafficking. It means people, like when you fill out your income tax return and you write down, you know, I sold 30 oranges last year, they, I'm sure they're not paying income tax, but they say they would say, I sold X amount of people last year. And they're getting very, very wealthy on selling people. Slavery is not an issue of the past. And actually, if you go online and you type in Super Bowl and human trafficking, what you'll find is that the single greatest event in American culture that where this happens the most is at the Super Bowl. In this host city, all these people come in for the game, and it's a great cover for people who want to come in and sell other human beings to other human beings. It's actually the weekend when we're eating those little like cocktail weenies and, you know, hanging out with our friends watching the big game, there are people being bought and sold while we're watching the big game. That's real life for 30 million people in the world. In the U.S., we have around 60,000 victims of this kind of human trafficking today in our world. And those people, they probably aren't coming from the powerful. I would imagine that these women and children are being taken from impoverished situations where people are making terrible decisions. We'll just sell them and we'll make a little money to take care of. And so this is happening. And I would imagine that God hears this cry. Would you agree with me? And I think what God is looking for is some Moseses to step up and be willing. And there are some. There's a great great group called End It Movement, and you can go to enditmovement.com and see what's going on in the world with human trafficking. And also, International Justice Mission, if you follow them on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, it's really encouraging. They actually go into places where they find out human trafficking is happening, and they go and work for freedom, and they'll do these covert ops with local police, and they will actually rescue. I saw yesterday they rescued some girls from a sex trade. So if you want to just be encouraged that in this world where 30 million people are being bought and sold, there are groups of people who are being Moses, and they're actually saying this is unacceptable that this is happening in our world, and they're doing something about it. And for us, I mean, you think, but that's, what do we do about that? It's as insignificant as finding out where your food and clothing comes from, because lots of our food and clothing come from places that people aren't being given a fair wage to produce what they're producing. So, and this is the real sort of world we live in, and we kind of insulate ourselves, and we get really caught up in insignificant things that don't matter when there are real things to be, challenges to be met. And then secondly, the Exodus isn't just a past event. It really isn't. I think what gives the Bible power isn't that it happened. It's that it happens. What makes the story of the Garden of Eden powerful, whether you believe that was literal or not, what makes that story powerful and true is not just that it happened at some point in the past. What makes it powerful and true is, that's my story. Is that your story? The whole Garden of Eden, forbidden fruit. I want to be God and play God all the time in my life, and I want to be God and play God in your life. And you know, that's my story. What makes the Exodus so powerful is not just that it happened to some Hebrew slaves a long, long time ago. What makes the Exodus story powerful is that it still happens all the time. Because you and I still need to be set free. And that brings us to this word we use a lot. How many of you ever heard this word used, saved, at church? How many of you ever have actually said the phrase, I got saved? It's almost like you just couple that with, and I saved 15% on my car insurance. You know what I mean? It's like that kind of thing. I got saved, 15% on car insurance. It's been a banner day. The word saved, the way we use it, is actually, we use it like this. We believe a few things to be true. We check them off so that we can have a good situation in the afterlife. That's what saved means for us, right? We're saved from hell. We're saved from bad things. We're saved for heaven. And lots of times people paint heaven as being this eternal church service. Who's pumped about that? I've seen you checking your watches. You're like, is it time yet? I mean, can you imagine this going on but forever? I mean, as good as I love this, I love it. I love you guys. But like, I'm going to be ready to go home in a minute. You know what I mean? I'm going to be ready to, I mean, nobody wants, if that's heaven, we need a better option because that's not very good. This word save, though, we've really turned it into something that it maybe it means all those things, but that's not what it means in the Bible. The word saved in the Bible draws its meaning from the Exodus story. This is where it appears. And the word saved primarily in the Bible doesn't mean believe some things so that things will go better for you. The primary meaning, because that's not, I mean, in some ways, that is not even grace. What does grace look like? Grace looks like God meeting us and bringing us out. The word saved in the Bible draws its meaning. It means liberation. It means being set free. It means deliverance. Salvation in the Bible is about what God, it began to be talked about in response to what God did for some Hebrew slaves who were being mistreated. What did God do? He sent Moses, who had a deep bass voice, and said, "Let my people go," right? This is the story. That's where salvation gets its meaning. So if we think of salvation in that way, because here's my problem talking about it the other way. We can say we got saved all day long and still be miserable. And we can get saved 100 times. I remember being at a revival service where this guy preached this, hellfire damnation, scared. I think our pastor was even scared, like at the end of the sermon. And then we had a tornado warning, and we're all in the basement, and I saw this kid get saved 15 times. Like, no joke. He got saved 15 times. That's not ultimately helpful, because that doesn't mean transformation. Believing some things doesn't lead to a new being. It just means you can be the same old you with just different beliefs. Right? What the Bible invites us to when it talks about being saved is it's inviting us to be liberated. Now, that can have afterlife implications, absolutely. But it doesn't begin with that. It begins with what's going on in the real world where we live now, the place we can actually do something about. It begins there. And so when we think about salvation, let's think about it like this. And the reason the Exodus story still matters is we all need to continually be set free, continually be liberated, continually be delivered from attitudes. And can we be honest? How many of you have ever thought about something and thought at the end of that, that's really probably not a very good attitude? And generally, it's about groups of people. Sometimes with Christians, it's about groups of people we don't even know. Right? Or it's about people who we don't feel like are measuring up to our religious expectations. We really feel called to be the spiritual bus monitors for the world. And we're right and you're wrong. And it's funny. It's not even like Christians, we cannibalize ourselves. You know what I mean? Like, one group of Christians is against another group of Christians because we don't have the same exact beliefs, right? So there's these attitudes that are ultimately not about healing and restoration of the world, not about building bridges between us and people we're alienated from, but they actually make the bridges and the chasm bigger. Actions. How many of you ever do something and you think, man, I really need to be rescued from that. I need to be delivered from the way I'm acting. And sometimes I've found that we are really good because we're not really brave. So what we do, we're passive aggressive all the time. You know what I mean? You know what I mean by passive aggressive? I mean, we're not brave enough to actually say what we need to say. So we say it in a way that's like, you ever been given one of those comments? Like where somebody tells you at the end, like, well, that was a good sermon. I.e. the rest of them have been God awful. But that one was okay. You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. We're passive aggressive. We take shots at each other. And sometimes God wants to rescue us from these destructive actions. And sometimes it goes even farther. We're doing things to our own body. We're doing things to other people. We're harming them. And we just need to be liberated from these actions that are leading us not toward freedom, but are actually keeping us in bondage and slavery. We need to be rescued. And I believe this one is so true in my life. And I really believe it's true in almost everybody. No, we need to be rescued from fear. How many of you are fearful of failing? Reality check. At some point in your life, you're going to try something, and you're going to fail miserably. Have a great week. But you are, and I am. Every time we have a home improvement project, it reminds me. I don't have a fear of failure. I have a certainty of failure when it comes to home improvement tasks. And of praying lots later to make up for everything that just happened. But, you know, there's this fear of failure. So you're going to try some things and you're going to fail. And you're going to try some things and you're going to be wildly successful, whatever success looks like. Because I don't think it's measured in the same ways we want to measure it. It's not about how much money you make. It's not about, you know, what people think about you. Success looks different in different contexts. But we're afraid of failing. And sometimes, if you're like Moses, the fear of failure keeps you from being God's voice and a voice of liberation. And I wonder how many of us, our fear of failure is keeping us from saying, God, you got a body right here. Right? I think sometimes we have this crippling fear of being wrong. I used to really fear being wrong. I've embraced it. It's something you embrace because we're all going to be wrong from time to time. And most of the time I don't know when I'm wrong, but I've been surrounded by lots of lovely, kind people who pointed out all the time but we're going to be wrong about some things. I tell you this almost every week, but I believe it's true. I think one of the biggest religious anxieties we have is that we're going to get something wrong about God or the Bible or something. And let me just put that to you. You are. I am. When I leave this life, I'm going to leave here with a lot of wrong opinions about the Bible and a lot of wrong opinions about God and a lot of wrong opinions about people. But that's not, I don't think God is going to meet me and say, well, you lived however many years. Let's say I lived to be 85. You lived 85 years and you didn't have all this figured out. No, that's not the God Jesus tells us about. The God Jesus tells about isn't this angry, oppressive God who's looking over our shoulder all the time, trying to catch us messing up. The God Jesus tells us about loves the flowers and he loves the birds, but he loves us even more. And I got to believe that whatever that moment looks like when we check out of this life into the next, I think we're going to be met with grace, not with, well, you didn't read your fourth century church history deep enough because you would have found out. No, it's not God. We need to let go. I think sometimes we miss out on experiencing what God is doing right here, right now, the new thing God is up to. We miss out because we're so afraid. We're so afraid of getting it wrong. And I don't think we need to try to get it wrong, but I think we need to be courageous enough and willing enough to follow where God's leading, even if it ends up that at the end of it all, when we check out, that we didn't get it all right. We need to be set free from, there are certain beliefs that just enslave us, beliefs about ourselves, beliefs about what it means to be human, beliefs about what God is like that really aren't, I mean, have you ever heard somebody talk about God and you thought, if I had to believe in that God, I'm out? You ever heard somebody talk about God that way? If I got to believe in that God, I'm not believing in God. We need to sometimes let go of beliefs that enslave us so that we can be brought into a life of freedom, joy, and aliveness. Because I really do believe that God wants us to be free, and I really do believe that God wants us to have joy. I really do believe that. And I think God is the author of joy. And I don't just mean at church. I think sometimes we think that that's where God wants you to be really happy. And sometimes you leave church happy, and sometimes you don't. And that's okay. Some, you know, joy is great in this context. But this is, I mean, I like to believe that when we do anything that brings us great joy and that it's good and beautiful, I believe God delights in that. You know, whether that's art or, you know, maybe you're an avid interpretive dancer. I don't know what it is that you do. Whatever that thing is that brings you joy, I believe that God made you to enjoy that, right? So, and then this we've been talking about aliveness, the full life, the real abundant life that God wants us to have. When we're set free from all this other stuff, it makes that possible. You can't be fully alive and have all sorts of attitudes and be engaging in actions and practices and being fearful. We will never be fully alive as long as those things are controlling us. So we need to be set free. It's a picture of the Last Supper. It's actually not taken at the Last Supper. This is an artist rendering. It probably looked nothing like this. What I like about this, though, is it reminds us that in Jesus' day, this Exodus story, this was their central narrative. This was what they were waiting on. God is going to raise up a Messiah. And every year when they celebrated Passover, you got to believe they were wondering, is it going to be this year? Is it going to be one of us? God's going to raise up a liberator to lead us to freedom. Freedom from the Romans, freedom from oppression. And the liberator God raised up looked very different than they expected, than we expect. The night before Jesus was executed, he met with his disciples in a room, and he engaged in an ancient practice of a Passover Seder where they had some components, and these components told the story of their rescue from Egypt. And Jesus essentially told his disciples, this means something totally different for us now. Because the Exodus that God brought about in Egypt was nothing compared to the Exodus he's about to bring about in human history. He's going to lead us not out of physical oppression. He's going to lead us out of spiritual bondage. Not just out of a physical geography into a new physical geography. He's going to lead us into a new realm of spirituality, where we can actually be set free from these attitudes, behaviors, things that are actually, and the Bible talks about it as the flesh, it talks about it as sin, this idea that there are things that are inhibiting us and keeping us back from being the fully alive human beings God made us to be. Paul actually put it like this: Christ has set us free for freedom. Therefore, stand firm and don't submit to the bondage of slavery again. But you were called to freedom, brothers and sisters. Only don't let this freedom be an opportunity to indulge your selfish impulses, because then you're not really free anymore. What you often find is what we call freedom is just another kind of slavery. Instead, serve one another through love. As the law has been fulfilled in a single statement, if you want to sum the Bible up to one point for Paul, it's this: love your neighbor as yourself. You bite and devour each other. Be careful that you don't get eaten by each other. I would just leave it with this: true freedom, the true exodus that we need, that Jesus is inviting us to, this true aliveness, this real full life, full joy and peace we've been offered, It's being set free from hate, being set free from pride, from anger, from bitterness, from revenge, from selfishness, from fear. And I put the dot, 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 because I bet there are lots of us have lots of more things to add. I've got things I want to add to that, but I just don't want you to know about them. So I mean, all these things we need to be set free from so that we can love and serve others, because that's what true freedom looks like. True freedom is being set free and using that freedom to help set others free. And I think that's the point. I think when religion turns into we're free and the rest of you all are just bad, that's when it goes sour. We're being set free. I'm not completely free yet, but man, I'm hopefully closer than I was yesterday. We're being set free, and we want to invite others to be set free too, because this is what we believe Jesus is up to. This is why we celebrate Jesus' body broken and blood poured, because it's about freedom. It's about being set free from your past, set free from guilt and shame and all the stuff that life ends up sticking on us through our mistakes or through others' mistakes. It's about being set free from that to join God in his remaking and rescuing and restoring and healing of everything. Because God needs a body. God needs a body. And that's yours. And that's mine. Let's pray. God, thank you for the story of our ancient ancestors who were slaves. Slaves who have been rescued, set free, brought out. And for those of us this morning who are here, and we would just say basically, based on where our lives are right now, we need to be saved in the same way. We need to be delivered. We need to be rescued. We need to be brought out. Whether that's from a way of living, a certain patterns we're engaging in, and actions that are destructive and unhelpful, whether that's just a heart that is so hard and calloused that it has no room for God or others, whatever that liberation for us will look like today, would you give us the courage to begin that step as we take this bread and dip it in this cup to just say, God, you know the exodus I need, and I open my heart. Whatever that looks like, however long it takes, whatever. The exodus was not an easy process back then, and it won't be now. It'll be a journey. But may we open ourselves up to that journey. And for those of us who are here, we find ourselves in the place of Moses. And you're inviting us to step into something new and challenging. You're inviting us to join you so that you can make a difference in the world. Because what you really need is a body. Give us the courage, with all of our fears and all of our inadequacies and all the ways we feel like we just can never measure up, give us the courage to simply say, here I am. We're grateful that you're always with us and that you will and long for our freedom and liberation. May we accept that gift of grace today. I pray in Jesus' name. And everybody said, and our students have communion, and we'd love to invite you. If you're a guest, if you're here every week, we want to invite you to join us as we take this bread and dip it in this cup to honor Jesus. And let's stand and sing.